on tape? Good. You taping right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Cooperative presents Earth on the Air.
During the next 30 minutes, Earth on the Air's independent contributors explore a public school that's become a hub of environmental activism, a gathering of alternative energy pioneers, a United Nations effort to improve the lives of indigenous peoples, satire and radio drama. But first, let's hit the streets with a section called Getting Around.
Hi, my name is Susan Gleason, and I'm a bicycle commuter in Seattle, at least part of the time. And I've been thinking a lot about the relationship between bicyclists and motorists. In most U.S. cities, they're forced to share the road, but I've always thought this was an awkward and dangerous coupling. Well, I spent a recent sunny day talking to some people who didn't want anything to do with bikes, and others to whom bicycling is a way of life, like Rob, manager of a popular bicycle shop.
We can make a real significant change in what we're doing to our planet simply by riding a bike instead of driving a car. It's tough to compete with cars, but you have to make a commitment to deciding that you're going to help the planet. If you look at the statistics of how long the average car trip is, the average commute is under 5 miles. In fact, 55% of the time that you get in your car, you travel less than 5 miles.
Do you bicycle to work?
Well, I like to bicycle to work when it's an option.
Yeah, I do. About 12 miles a day, usually. Unless it's pouring, then occasionally I borrow my wife's car.
It's easier and faster for me to ride my bike than drive my car.
Why do you like to ride your bike?
It's fun. Get in the air, burn some calories, cheap exercise.
You don't worry about being sweaty or carrying extra clothes to work?
I don't know about the other bike riders. I don't ride that hard. I make it kind of a sightseeing tour to and from when I can.
I think a lot of employers should have showers on their facilities.
I'm wondering if you ride a bicycle.
Nope.
It's too hard.
Too many crazy people. Too many drivers. I'd rather be in a truck with something more to protect me.
What feels unsafe about riding in the city?
Oh, having to deal with the traffic, weaving in and out.
Riding the streets is a little nerve-wracking.
I'm wondering how you feel about bicyclists as a motorist.
I love them.
All be bicyclists.
I'm a bicyclist, too.
There should be no cars.
It's good for the environment. I wish they were a little more conscious of traffic laws. You know, a majority of them have a tendency to ignore most laws that the rest of us have to follow.
They get in the way. You feel like you want to run them over or something.
I'm Officer Bob Seavey with the Seattle Police Department, and I work mounted patrol, and that's on horses. I commute to work by bicycle several days a week.
Yeah, why do you think the motorists get mad at the bicyclists?
Well, I think most of them that I've seen get mad at them because a lot of the bicyclists don't follow the rules of the road. They're required to follow the same rules as vehicles, and a lot of them don't. They blow stop signs. They don't ride as far over to the right as they can. They don't signal. They don't do a lot of things. They think they're exempt from the rules. And that frustrates a lot of people.
My name is Phil Sider. I'm the department lead at Recreational Equipment Incorporated in Seattle.
Do you ride your bike to work?
Every day.
Do you think it's safe?
I think it's safe, provided that the rider is properly educated. That is, learning to anticipate motorist moves, anticipate motorists making illegal moves. Just learning to ride as if you're not seen at all.
What do you think would make it safer?
An effort on the city's part to put in more marked bike lanes and perhaps even road signs to indicate to bicyclists recommended routes. A lot of people who are interested in commuting to work, for example, really don't have the first clue on how to get to work. You know, usually they get on the freeway. Well, on your bike, you can't do that. And so they don't always know what's the safest route to take.
If it was safer, though, would you ride?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It can work. I think that our leaders need to provide the facility for better commuting. There's lots of room for improvement.
Next in this getting around portion of Earth on the Air, a Tuesday evening visit to the bus stop at 45th and Meridian.
It's the most democratic form of transportation you can get.
you know. And you meet all kinds, you see all kinds, and that's what I think.
And you get to see, you know, interesting people. People that you probably wouldn't normally see sometimes.
People who just dress a little more liberally, and right. maybe that occasional person who talks to themselves, yes, you know, or something.
Else, right.
You don't think there's a class differentiation
yes,
thing?
Yes, there definitely is.
You think there is?
Oh, fuck yes. When people say, oh, you don't have a car? Oh, my God, they think you're like a social misfit or ass cat.
You don't see that changing at all now with the environmental movement?
It'll be a long time coming, and I'm afraid Mother Earth is going to give out before then, honey.
Lifestyles have to change. Something has to go, and I think a lot of people are just saying, well, this is way more convenient than driving now, so why not just do it?
I think once they make the mass transportation sort of futuristic and appealing, and it's a cultural kind of social thing to do, instead of polluting the environment with these gas, hog, armored trucks, you know, just like they do in Japan.
What would your dream bus be like? You ever have a dream about how buses ought to be?
Yeah, I'd be there at it every time I wanted to get on them, you know.
So you don't have to wait here for them.
But I have to wait.
What about people that refuse to ride the bus, that never ride the bus?
Well, I would think that they're kind of stuck up. That they're not aware of the multicultural and ethnic differences in the city.
Ask her who she's going out with.
A bus driver.
That you met on the bus?
Yes, he was my regular bus driver.
Say that again.
I must confess, if I had the money, I would have a chauffeur-driven Rolls. Oh, my God.
So you must have to sort of just get into a different rhythm or something, just slow down. And
pretty much have to go with the bus schedule. You learn to apply yourself to a bus schedule.
I don't know. For riding the bus, for me, it's a lot less stressful than when I'm driving, because when I'm driving, I'm just all nerves. I get home and I want to play war games or something.
There I go.
There's your bus. During the 1950s, U.S. tire companies, oil companies, and auto manufacturers were charged with conspiracy to wipe out light rail transit systems that had been thriving since the turn of the century. Some of these companies were found guilty of violating federal antitrust laws, but the deed was pretty much done. Roadways had already become the way of getting around, and rail systems have been fighting for life ever since. Environmental activist Kathy Bloom had a chat with the director of the nonprofit Institute for Transportation and the Environment. She asked Chris Lehman if he suspected a present-day conspiracy.
Well, I think conspiracy, it's almost too small a word to describe what's going on, because what's going on is quite open. If you just look at how the decisions on how we spend the billions of dollars that we're now spending on road building get allocated, it's just a kind of a revolving door. The people who work in government often go to work for the lobbies that are benefiting from this road construction. The road building lobby contributes money to the candidates and the incumbents, who benefit obviously in their careers from voting a certain way. The saddest thing of all, obviously, is that it's very short-sighted. What we have found everywhere in the world is that road building cannot solve our traffic problems, that it just makes them bigger. It encourages the automobile. The automobile is not an efficient way to move people. It produces more than its share of pollution and wastes energy and money. But in the short term, the incentives for the politicians are to go ahead and try to build our way, pave our way out of our traffic problems.
So how do we deal with all of this? How do we prevent more roads from being built? How do we improve our bus systems? How do we make it more safe for cyclists to ride around? What can the average person do, the average person who doesn't have a lot of time?
Well, the first thing we have to do is just be frank that the decks are stacked against citizens getting involved in transportation decisions. And it's about time that there were more public hearings and more mailings and more opportunity for citizens to sound off. So it's a tall order. Transportation is a growing proportion of all kinds of pollution, solid waste, air pollution, water pollution, noise, and we just haven't yet addressed it. And people who want to get involved should know that this could well become a lifetime effort on their part.
Hi, I'm Gary.
And I'm Larry.
I've got the East.
And I've got the West. And together,
we're
Earth in the Air
traffic.
How's it doing in the East?
Heavy volumes. Take alternate routes. Go west.
No, don't. Congestion through the nasal passage. Stay off the main arterials. Head east.
Mrs. Farnsworth's flower bed looks clear from here.
Major slowdowns in Dead Man's Curve. Avoid if possible. Gary, how's the bridge?
Well, we got a hit on. All eastbound, westbound, southbound, northbound, up, down, and diagonal bound lanes are blocked.
All the freeway overpasses are jammed. Well, I think in this town nobody's going anywhere.
I think I'm going up to a higher altitude to get a better view. Yeah, it looks like gridlock from Boston to Washington.
Looks like bumper to bumper up and down the West Coast with disabled vehicles everywhere.
And in the East, there's gridlock in Congress over here. No progress on alternative transportation.
It's getting a little choppy up here.
Yes, I can barely see. These cars are creating their own ozone layer.
From here, it looks like they're all leaving their cars. It's a perpetual traffic jam.
Well, that's job security for us.
Well, that's all for now. Back to you.
Thanks, fellows. Satire from reformed beachcomber Ted Jessen. You're listening to Earth on the Air. Citizen involvement. That's what videographer John Ariel Murphy's interested in. He's also interested in alternative energy. So when he heard about a public alternative energy fair at a college in Bellevue, Washington, he grabbed a tape recorder and went to check it out.
In the courtyard, a banjo player is entertaining a sparse gathering of alternative energy devotees who are perusing displays of innovative hardware, a small solar-powered motor, a giant windmill blade. Exotic pedal-powered devices weave their way through the courtyard, showing off new experiments in bicycle design. In a nearby parking lot, a half dozen electric cars are on display. One of the cars looks like a sexy red McLaren M6 race car. It's actually a fiberglass body mounted on a Volkswagen frame and was built by Steve Lowe, one of the organizers of the fair.
Our approach here in this energy fair is trying to look at it holistically, in as much that the electric vehicles, as they exist now or will at the turn of the century, are not going to solve the problems of gridlock. It may cut pollution back, but we'd still have gridlock. We'd all be just battery gridlocked instead of gas gridlocked.
In the classrooms adjoining the courtyard are workshops on subjects such as building your electrical car, living lightly, renewable energy, and transportation strategies.
And this is a new Swiss version of an American mountain bike.
Engineer Bill Yerkes is the former president of Arco Solar, the world's largest producer of solar cells.
If you pedal a little bit, it provides reduced gearing, and your pedal effort adds to the electric motor. It was kind of a clever little gearbox, so normally on the level you can zing along and not pedal and go 25, 30 miles an hour with this thing. And then when you start up a hill, if you just pedal a little bit, you reduce the gear ratio of your electric motor, plus add your own pedaling effort to it.
Yerkes says it's individuals and local communities that need to create the solutions. Olaf Sundin, who has built his own electric car, agrees. He is the main organizer of the fair. He's also a part-time instructor at the college in the Addiction Studies program, which gives him a unique perspective on what currently passes for an energy policy in the United States.
What we are not doing vis-a-vis the environment, to me, fits into the addictive model. The facts are out here, folks. We're destroying the planet. Or if you're a cocaine addict or an alcoholic, the facts are very obvious. Your life is out of control. But there is denial. We're afraid of change.
And changing something as fundamental as our relationship to the energy that powers our lives means change with a capital C. These changes are going to involve sacrifices on everyone's part, according to former U.S. Congressperson Mike Lowry.
We're not pricing those fuels at a true cost. We're not pricing them at a replacement cost. We're not pricing them at a cost of protecting the environment. So it's that huge subsidy. Right. So if it was possible, you could just sit there and say, we're going to price those at a real cost. That right there would move the solar energy market and so on, you know.
But how will a policy that involves, for instance, a substantial increase in the price of gasoline ever pass muster with the American people? From the looks of the turnout this morning, not many are ready to throw themselves on the barricades to demand change. But the small turnout hasn't discouraged fair organizer Olaf Sundin.
So we have X hundred people here today rather than X thousand people here. But you know, if we had been in New Orleans in 1841 and run a little convention for the freedom of the slaves, it wouldn't have been real popular. But it just might be right.
Oh Lord, I'm 61, how we long as road I know. Oh Lord, I'm 61, how we long as road I know. I go right from Atlanta, Georgia to the Gulf of Mexico.
Next on Earth on the Air, Russell Lawrence Barsh represents British Columbia's native Mi'kmaq nation at the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. He talks about native efforts to respond to the upcoming world commemorations in 1992, 500 years after Columbus was said to have discovered the New World. One UN response was determined in December 1990 with a proclamation of an international year for the world's indigenous people.
It went through by a vote of 150-0 with four abstentions. The four abstentions were four Caribbean countries, which said that they were going to abstain because they didn't think the UN resolution on the year was strong enough. And the language of the resolution is operational. It's about technical cooperation, which means projects, human rights, development, environment, health, education, things that strengthen communities from inside.
So it's not just a declaration.
This is fundamental to the idea of the year. We refused in the negotiations on this over the last 4 years to accept what would be called in the UN a promotional year, a year to declare and proclaim what nice folks indigenous people are and everybody should love them and respect them. And we absolutely refused to accept that. It was fundamental to our strategy that the UN make a commitment of resources and that this be a year of focalized operational activity to translate doing things with indigenous people at the grassroots using UN resources and facilities.
The year starts 1992, is that correct?
Well, this is an interesting and I think...
So that's the quincentenary.
This is the quincentenary, right. When we originally came up with this idea a few years ago, we of course wanted it to be in 92 because at that time the indigenous movement globally was mostly coming from North and South America. It hadn't yet extended into Asia. And for the North and South Americans, of course, 1492 to 1992, I mean, this is the symbolic turning point as far as we're all concerned. So we had tried to make it 92, and we were very effectively opposed by the government of Spain, which got all the white countries to get together and object to this, saying that this was, you know, just going to spoil all the nice, positive, warm, and fuzzy things that might come out of 1992. What it really meant is they didn't want us to rain on their parade on Barcelona, you know, on the World's Fair and everything else. What we did was we played a little game of agreeing to make it the next year, 93, getting that, and understanding full well that an operational year, a year of activities, is going to require advanced planning, preparatory meetings, and so on. and that we're bound to be able to work into the plan of action, that the work really begins in 92. So we're now working at the level of trying to get this whole complicated gearing up process in the UN that will lead to a year of focused work to begin in 92, to have critical meetings at a high level with the heads of state and with the Secretary General and such, all happening during the quincentenary year, so that instead of thinking about what a wonderful guy Columbus was when he bumped into Hispaniola, people are thinking about what are we going to do now to support the people who were the victims of that so-called discovery.
Okay, so this is the International Year of the World's Indigenous Peoples is not going to be divorced from the quincentenary.
No, we hope, in fact, that it is the logical follow-up, that the quincentenary is the, let us say, the preface or the foreword to the international year. And that will lead naturally into the question of, now what are we going to do for the next 500 years? Are we going to let the situation continue? Or are we going to mobilize international resources to give indigenous people a chance to recover their future, recover their destiny for themselves?
And now, a message from our industrial society concerning your buying habits.
Hi, Mom. Can I have some processed food product?
These days, my kids and I are so busy. That's why I keep plenty of processed packaged food product on hand. It's loaded with the chemicals our corporate system needs to sell in order to stay economically healthy. And with its packaging, I get to teach my kids to care for the earth by recycling. Try that with unpackaged vegetables. Processed food product, because I love my kids.
Packaged processed food products, because we love our kids.
That message was created by Daniela Chase and Tom Baer. Tom Baer is a freelance writer with a special interest in education. He heard about a school where most of the students were upset about all the clear-cutting of forests in the Pacific Northwest, so upset that they decided to try to do something about it. Tom visited the school and brought back this piece.
So I went home one day and my stepdad asked me, why are you so down and everything? And I just started talking to him. And he said that we should do more than just, you know, watch videos on it.
That's 8th grader Dennis Klein, a student at Kopachuk Middle School in Gig Harbor, Washington, telling how he and his class began a petition campaign for preserving old-growth forests. Under the guidance of their teacher, Dennis's class wrote a petition under the group name Young Scientists Doing Something, stating their belief that clear-cutting goes on mainly because of government and timber companies' greed for money. Their letter and petition proposes a compromise with fragmented forestry, that is, cutting trees in small, spread-out clumps instead of large clear-cuts. Nearly everyone at Kopachuk Middle School and nearly all of the students' parents signed the Young Scientists Doing Something petition, along with many other people in the Peninsula School District. In mid-June, they sent the signed petitions to timber companies, Gig Harbor's state legislative and national congressional delegations, the governor and the president, and the United Nations.
What I'm hoping next year, when school starts again, is I may have some letters saying, you know, it's really nice when children like you do something like this, now get lost, or we're going to sue you, or this is terrific. I'm glad to hear from you.
Science teacher John Valentine saw himself more as a consultant than a leader in the project.
I think for them to connect what they do in school with what they want to do with themselves is very important. It's rare when you can succeed in doing that.
I really didn't recycle that much, but I wasn't like into it, but now I've studied everything and how the ecosystem is so delicate. I recycle a lot.
After we started studying this, I decided to be like a marine biologist because a lot of the oceans are getting destroyed too.
I asked Mr. Valentine if he was concerned about angry reactions from parents and school district administrators.
I sort of expected it, and nothing's happened so far. I was explaining to the students what might happen, and they were ecstatic at the idea of somehow raising some cane, really stirring things up. They thought that was a great idea.
Connectivities like this that ask students to think about and act on their beliefs be part of the broad educational reform that is supposedly happening.
I know there are a lot of teachers, many of them who are far ahead of this project, But nonetheless, it's not district policy. The districts are dragging their feet. It's not state curriculum. It's a lot of teachers who do it on their own.
Some of the students say they want to continue with young scientists doing something and perhaps expand its issues of concern beyond old-growth forests. John Valentine plans to develop activities like this into multidiscipline curriculums. In this case, science classes would discuss ecosystems, English classes would draft the petitions, social studies classes would talk about effects on jobs and lifestyles, and so on. Such coordination already happened this year at Kopachuk, and Mr. Valentine is confident that it will get stronger in years to come.
Finally on Earth on the Air, Washington State poet David Lloyd Whitehead reads a couple of his poems. The first is called Leather Soles.
I saw two loggers kiss today, fast and sharp to show their friendship. They were drunk or near it in a bale of hay sawdust little tavern full of beer and western songs. The barmaid said that Saturday was the night for all the local yokels to be drunk. She didn't know I was, and the place was full of stumble-drunk people, warm and loud and drunk, and I liked it, even though I was alone. And in this dim bar light, these two just blundered into each other, growled and pawed the air. Slow recognition cleared the mist. Laughter, bear hug, and then they kissed. And I nearly fell off that stool. Maybe the beer helped a bit, but still, I'd never seen two loggers kiss, and probably won't again. Planting trees. If there is action here doing this, then it has to be the least bad in the woods. Less guilt. This, or digging fire trail, or stacking brush, cleaning out the creek. But that's summer work. In winter, the trees are planted, and it's cold work. The rain freezes on our backs. 800 trees in a pack. Out in the woods again, where they've cut. And it feels good to do this to the woods. It's like the land is naked and skinny and all its bones are sticking out. And the rocks, cliffs, this steep. And we point. We planted a unit yesterday that was like the cathedral. You remember the cathedral? Rock walls and trees all around, but for the clear cut. And we were there, dressing her back up. And I could picture what it was going to be like 10, 20 years from now, all slick green. And I looked around, and there was all these trees, and they'd been cut before, maybe 50 years ago, and here were these new ones we'd packed in on our backs, pacing the distance and slicing them into the ground. I could see the brush and snags burning like old bones, the bones of dead animals. The trees also scatter and melt into the ground, growing softer with death, filling with water, losing color, and leaving. You know what I mean. How salmon even melt here.
David Lloyd Whitehead's latest collection of poems entitled The Eleven is awaiting publication. That's the show. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, it's your program too. Write Earth on the Air for tape submission guidelines at P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145. That's Earth on the Air, Box 45883, Seattle 98145. We'd be delighted to work with you. If you'd like a cassette copy of this show, call 1-800-767-1929. Mention that you want program number 4. We had additional help from Scott Bergen, Diane Michael, Jalaire Box, and Marilee and Noria Gomez. Additional music was by David Hines, Jim Page, Artist the Spoon Man, Philae Gumbo, Carol Ann Stockton, and Randy. Production facilities provided by Jack Straw Productions and KCMU in Seattle, as well as KSER in Linwood, Washington. Partial funding was by the New Roadmap Foundation and Pacifica Program Service. For Earth on the Air, I'm Peter Mayloff.